Hello, hello, everyone. It's 4 o'clock on Friday. I feel like I should start by singing, I'm so glad we had this time together. So, anyone new, though? Has anyone not been seen my little spiel before?
Oh,
hi, welcome, welcome. So glad you're here. So I'm Anna Marie Vegan, and I teach at Loyola University Chicago. And each session, we've done something a little different, looking at historical construction of white identity and privilege, talking a little bit about our own stories and struggles with being comfortable in our own skin as white people, those of us who identify as white, and the stages of white identity formation. Yesterday, we took a long, hard look at what is racism, and we looked at 25 minutes of a film about the GI Bill and housing discrimination and the dramatic differences in wealth accumulation, the legacy that that's had. Just so you know, there are articles that I quickly passed around last time about various kinds of inequalities, health and healthcare inequalities, wealth inequalities, housing and civil rights, social circles when they become small, when we self-segregate ourselves and our social circles are predominantly the same socioeconomic and racial ethnic identity as ourselves, what happens. So feel free to take screenshots of any of those. Also, if you're new, don't leave without taking a handout on some resources that might be of use to you beyond Holden. So with that very brief introduction, and of course these are all books that I'll mention or you can take screenshots of that I highly recommend. So with that quick intro to the other sessions, today our focus is really on how can we become better and better at being trustworthy allies, again, for those of us who identify as white. The point of this session is that talking and reading and reflecting are all great, and I know that we will all continue to do those things. But without action, without deciding to take some concrete steps and enact some kind of strategies in our own lives, wherever we are normally living and not holding, then things won't really change much around us, in our own hearts and minds, our own understandings of privilege and the kind of people we want to be, won't change either. So hopefully, come on in, we have plenty of seats over here. So hopefully today you'll leave with some constructive ideas of steps that you can take, little by little, to implement in your own spheres of influence. Briefly, I want to define racism one more time. For those especially who weren't here yesterday, prejudice plus power, which is what Michael and Mark gave us in their session earlier this week. I emphasize that it's individual, cultural, institutional levels. So it's not just about intentions or manners or being good people. It's so much deeper than that. And I use this definition from Ijoma Oluo, that racism is any prejudice against someone because of their race when those views are reinforced by systems of power. So whereas everyone can have stereotypes and assumptions and prejudices of various kinds, without access to institutional power, it doesn't rise to the level of an ism, of a racism. Just like homophobia or heterosexism are tied to the fact that in the United States, straight people have got a whole lot more power about defining what is marriage or where you can go to the bathroom or that kind of thing. Some of that has changed, obviously, significantly, but other things, you can't take things for granted, right? It's easy to lose ground. So reverse racism in this country is really an oxymoron, because it's never been the case that communities of color have had the kind of institutional power in order to enact prejudice in a systemic way, the way white people have. So with that in mind, I brought up this example as well yesterday. Just so we looked a lot at housing yesterday and wealth disparities because of the fact that white families have been able to pass on wealth through a lot of home ownership and have been excluded, whereas people of color have been excluded from reasonable deals on housing mortgages and loans, and even just from being able to buy a home in many areas. Schools is a huge one as well. So this Supreme Court decision from 1974 has had lasting effects that are still with us today. So we are in a very segregated situation now in schools, socioeconomically and racial ethnically, and often those things are intertwined. And here now I wanted to say that we're at a crossroads. It's 4:05, so that's, see, like, we're plenty of time, but I really want to allow enough time for us to map these spheres of influence and things that you want to do, so I'm torn. I can tell you more about my son's school and the challenges that we've had, and I can show you a 9-minute video about implicit bias, but that's going to set us back. So, do it. What do we feel?
Do it.
I want to hear your son.
Okay, but you cannot get out of your homework. I just want that to be clear. I know that we like to watch things, just like my students, but we have to do our work. All right. So, Benjamin, are you here or did you take off?
We didn't.
He took off.
Okay, that's fine. I told him he didn't. So if he comes back, he can add his part of the story. But first of all, as many white parents who live in big urban environments and you get all stressed out about school, and it's silly. Like, when I went to school in South Dakota, there was one primary school, one middle school, one high school, no big deal. Chicago, it is insane. It's ridiculous. So when my son was 4 years old, Allison and I thought, well, we'll do what you do. You have him tested. He probably won't get into a selective enrollment school, public school. We knew we wanted to do that. And, you know, maybe it was the white hair. Maybe it's his outgoing personality. He wasn't reading at the time, and yet somehow he was very gregarious and clever. He's a thoughtful person even then. And he did get a slot. So instead of going to one of the schools very close to where we live in Rogers Park, he was offered a seat to do an advanced curriculum in a what had been more of a mixed neighborhood and was recently gentrifying a lot, in part because of the school. Rahm Emanuel, former mayor of Chicago, launched his mayoral campaign there. He took a lot of credit for improving the school where my son goes. And so it went from a pretty socioeconomically and racially diverse school. People started buying homes, property values went up. The school in Chicago that he goes to is one of the very few that has a full-time librarian, that has funding for drama and music and various after-school programs. They just built on a huge new addition. And there are students of color, and there are students who are less affluent, but it's pretty darn affluent. So for example, as I said yesterday, in Chicago, school funding is based on property taxes. So the schools right where we live are really underfunded, and home values are less. And the parents are much more diverse racially, ethnically, and much more diverse socioeconomically. So as we're the school close to us, they hope the parents, their PTA association, they shoot for like raising $7,000 or $8,000 a year to fix playground equipment or to buy some additional books and things like that. At the school where my son goes, also a public school, not a charter school, not a magnet school, just has an option for, it has one classroom per grade for students who aren't in the neighborhood who do the accelerated curriculum. And they're phasing that out, actually, because they are having so much space that they need just for the neighborhood's kids now, because parents have been flocking there, white, wealthy parents have been flocking there. Anyway, at my kids' school, when they do their annual Spring Fling fundraiser, the parents can raise $200,000 to $300,000 a year. A couple miles apart. So this is a quandary. So a lot of white parents feel conflicted about, we want the best, you know, what parent doesn't want the best for his or her or their child, right? But how do we define what the best means? And so what this has meant is that we're really having serious talks with our son about, you know what, we're not going to push the selective enrollment high schools. There's a very good high school. It is large. It has, it's very diverse in socioeconomically, racially, ethnically. He could walk there, but it doesn't have the prestige of like the elite high schools in Chicago. And we're like, you know what? You're going to be fine. And you will gain something by being in diverse classrooms with diverse teachers as well as a student body. So we don't know how it's all going to shake out. He's going into seventh grade and his school is K through eight. But we've really started to realize, in fact, one of his best friends who is black at that school left that school, he and his parents, because he just felt so isolated. As a black kid at that school, and not supported in the same way by teachers who are all white. So that's the very brief story of our quandary. And what I want you to know, this is a 9-minute video that we could skip or not, but it matters where you put your bodies and where you put your children's bodies and that of your friends and neighbors, because by age 4, 5, 6, children are already understanding, whether you ever say the word or not, that there are different races, and knowing their own racial identity and contrasting that with others. Implicit bias starts very, very early. And it happens even when well-intentioned folks who use egalitarian language, who say all people are created equal, and we already talked about how colorblindness is a myth, it doesn't work. We can't not see race. But even when we try to kind of use that, oh, we treat all people the same stuff, kids on the playground are making distinctions and are understanding the differences. So, you want to see the 9-minute video that describes that? Okay, but you have to do your homework. So I'm just all right, this is from 2012, Anderson Cooper's series on race.
We're debuting a really important 360 special report called Kids on Race, The Hidden Picture. It's a project over a year in the making. Now, race relations is one of the most explosive issues in this country, and for many adults, the most taboo to talk about with kids. But what a lot of adults don't realize is that kids, even as young as 6 years old, are already talking about or thinking about race. And what they say is making friends with kids of other races is hard and only gets harder as they grow up. We teamed up with renowned child psychologist Dr. Melanie Killen to scientifically measure children's attitudes on race. Take a look at this. Dr. Killen and her team showed 6-year-old children this picture and asked them questions like, what's happening here? Are these children friends, and would their parents want them to be friends? The picture is designed to be ambiguous. What's happening is in the eye of the beholder. Then they showed them this picture and asked the same question. Now, the only difference in the pictures, the race of the children was flipped. Both white and African-American children were tested, and in addition to the 6-year-olds, the psychologist showed a similar set of pictures to 13-year-olds. At our request, they also asked kids open-ended questions about race to try to understand how it plays into their own lives. The responses were raw. Some of the experiences they described were frankly shocking. This is the reality of what kids see, hear, and think about race. Listen.
If you have the same skin, you can play together, but if you don't have the same skin, you can't play together.
So why can't you play together if you have different color skin?
Because your mom might not want you to play with that friend.
That's okay to tell people that they can't be your friend because of the color of their skin?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that okay?
Because your mom will not want them to be the same, be a different color friends.
Do you think it'd be easy for a kid to convince his parents that it would be okay to have other types of people over? Or not?
Probably he might get in trouble.
Why would a parent want you to get in trouble if you wanted someone to come over to your house who is a different skin color?
Probably because they don't allow.
Why not? Why would some parents not allow other skin-colored kids to come over?
Probably because they might not like that skin color.
I've been really different, like the way I look and the way my skin came up.
I don't know what's happened, but maybe it's telling me you need your homework.
It was off the MRI that you did yesterday.
No, that was a DVD.
Okay.
Court. It's all been plugged in.
I'm still getting audio, so.
And it says that the source is
school that I went to, and they just kept on bullying me, and I didn't like it. I just asked them to stop, like, over and over again. And then I tried not to break, but I couldn't, like, hold on anymore. So I asked my mom, can I leave?
My grandparents had a lot of, they're very racist against African-Americans and like other races, but it's 2012, so they have to like push that aside.
So I'm not gonna do that. Just don't think that's a good use of our time.
Yeah.
The point of this, and you can Google it, all you have to do is Anderson Cooper 360 implicit bias. And there are 3 different segments that come up because they did the series a few different times, and you will see it there. But the interesting, and they can again, they worked with this sociologist at, wow, can I even get my PowerPoint? Yes. They worked with the sociologist at Mary Killian, and what they found is that, so implicit bias starts young, and that white kids have more negative associations of black kids. So when they tried to show the ambiguous pictures of somebody falling off a swing, what happened, the white kids were much more likely to say it was the black kid who pushed them. Whereas the black kid would say, when they looked at the picture of the child on the ground, the swinging, and the other child in the back, they would reverse the races, and they showed them one of each picture. The black children were more likely to say, oh, you know, Bobby's going to help the friend up, or something like that. So both children of color and white kids do all display some prejudice at times, but it gets worse, and the divide gets worse as they get older. And the other part of the story with this study from Killian and then shown on 360 with Anderson Cooper is that my son, because he saw this video in one of my classes at Loyola, it was one of those days when he was too sick to go to school, but I still needed a place for him to go, so he came to class with me, and he watched it, and then a year later, we hadn't talked about it again, but it was well over a year later that when they had science fair coming up, he said, I want to do that implicit bias test. I want to do it in my school. And so he worked with a sociologist at Loyola, where I work, because I knew I was the parent in this situation and not the educator, and I also am not a sociologist. So they designed a study that was doable. He did a ton of research and prep for it. And at first the science teacher had said no, and then she said yes, and then she said, I'm not so sure. And then she said, let's come in. I said, should we meet in person? So Ben and I went to meet with her. I said, can I bring my son? And she said, sure. We went before school. And lo and behold, it was not only the teacher, but the principal, who's white. They're both white. And it was the principal who was really worried. And he said, Ben, this is a great idea, but it's not appropriate for science fair. And because you'll be displaying these posters about implicit bias, and I don't want any child's feelings to get hurt. And I said, but you know that children are being hurt by implicit bias, and no identities will be revealed. And he said, well, yes, but they'll know how they answered Ben's questions. And then I said, how about if we do the study, but we don't interview any student at this school, we interview other Chicago kids that we know. So then it won't be so up and close. And he said, no, but I don't want any child harmed. And of course, the thing is that implicit bias is harming children every day. And all of the research is saying is how we address this is by talking about it, not by not talking about it. That makes it worse. I said, the last thing I said was, Ben, he has the authority to make this decision, and we'll do a different project, but I just have to have it be said that I believe this decision was made not with good reasons, but out of fear. And then the principal got really mad, and my son got really embarrassed. And the other thing about it is he is a white principal, but he's married to a black woman, and they have biracial sons who go to that school. And he also said, I wouldn't want my sons to participate in the study. So part of his thinking was, if we just don't talk about it, we'll just all watch each other. So, but another piece of that then is Margaret Hagerman's work. She's at MSU, Mississippi, and she did this. The book is in the bookstore. I forgot to bring my copy, but she did this amazing longitudinal study with white families who talk about, we don't see color, or we treat everybody the same and such, but then she talks to the kids as well and their thoughts about race, and she really, her research really shows how if you just say the right things, quote unquote, but you don't walk the talk, how your kids get very different messages. If you don't look to people of color as authorities, if you don't ask them, you know, as if they have information to share, if you don't have people in your lives who are, whether they're healthcare providers, professionals, teachers, friends, members at church, in your neighborhood, if they don't see you actually relating to people that are different from you racially, ethnically, then they don't get the message that the diversity really is all that important, or that people of other races have all that much expertise or to contribute. So she did an interview with The Atlantic, and I did ask folks to maybe take a look at it, and if you did, you can just see how some of her findings are. But what her summary is in this piece, and I can pass it around. But one of the things that she says in this interview is that white parents, we need to complexify our choices, not just what's good for our children, but we need to think about other people's children as well. And we need to rethink and redefine what is the best mean. So those are two of the thoughts that I would say quickly. And if there's time at the end, I can tell you more from this interview, but I think it's in the library. It's very quick and easy to find online. And then she's got this great book. So I'll just pass that around. So that's my basic spiel about how these things play out concretely in terms of schools. These are complicated choices. But now I really want us to spend most of the time thinking about how we can be better allies than maybe we have been. And I'm speaking not only to you, but to myself. These are things I continue to work on. I don't have all the answers. I'm certainly not a perfect person, and I make a lot of mistakes throughout. So Dr. Jen Harvey, who wrote White, Raising White Kids, not to be confused with Hagerman's book, which is just called White Kids. This is Raising White Kids. It's all about white parenting. She would offer these qualities that I've just kind of distilled from chapter 6 that I, or chapter 7 for today. First of all, this is a good Lutheran thing, I think. She's not Lutheran, but we have to be willing to be heartbroken. I think sometimes it is our instinct to try to shield those that we love from pain. To not talk about, yes, it's true, a police officer killed another black man who was unarmed, or woman. But we don't do ourselves or our children or our loved ones a service. And she said, in fact, she has written, in fact, given the days that we live in, if our hearts aren't broken, then we're losing a core part of our humanity. We need to be affected by these things. Remember in earlier days, I said, how did that make you feel? It's not just about rationalizing and intellectualizing and getting into this brain about, well, this is what I think. We have to just let ourselves feel these realities like a sucker punch. Just the way that many of us carry this, the gut ache about climate change, especially being here and seeing how much we love being in natural environments that are reasonably healthy. When these things happen, when children don't have the same opportunity, when people are discriminated against at work, when someone is shot without cause, we have to be just as heartbroken. And that also, then, we need to be vulnerable and not insulate ourselves from all of these things. Why? Because both qualities are pathways to empathy. I loved how Chris, for those of you who were able to attend Chris and Katie's session, when they gave the example of their dog, and training their dog is not just a technical issue. They had to figure out how to change their home and their lives. You know, we have to do cultural shifts, and we have to look hard at ourselves. That kind of empathetic response is much more holistic and useful than a simply, well, I'm going to come in here with a wrench and fix racism. It doesn't work, you know, that way. So the additional qualities, this is from Harvey, Oluo, and me, combined, willing to break silence. This is from Harvey. It is not at all uncommon for one white person breaking silence to free others up to do the same. Our verbal, visible, and constructive engagements for justice may very well reveal allies and co-participants that we wouldn't have recognized had we stayed silent or unengaged. Now, we have to think about how we want to speak, and that really depends a lot on our personalities and on the situation and such, but breaking silence is very powerful. We can be constructive and creative and kind, but also honest, humble. We have to own our mistakes and apologize. When I grew up in my family, man, you did not apologize because that meant defeat. I've had to really work hard to unlearn that, although probably Allison would tell you I still need to work on that. But to just say, I really screwed up, I am so sorry. And don't add but, and don't add my intention was, just stop, I'm sorry for the pain. So, and then be willing to lend your gifts without being in charge, the expert, the leader. Listen more, talk less. This also is very hard for me. I'm an extrovert and an educator. Mm-hmm. I have a PhD, I have way too much education than anyone could need, and I haven't even used it all that well. And so I come into the room and I think I have to talk a lot, and that's actually, I've had to work hard to unlearn that as well. Honest. In our schools, in our neighborhoods, in our family stories, in society, we have to complicate history. The example that Jennifer Harvey gives in one place in her book is that her white child was very excited about George Washington and was praising George Washington in second grade because of the unit they were doing. And they had then subsequent conversations about the fact that he owns people, that he owned slaves. So how do we both recognize the heroes and also tell the full story about our heroes? I mean, this was before Hamilton came out. So we have to tell the truth about white identity, that history that we did on day two. We can't just let that go. We got to keep reminding ourselves and others that this history is real, it matters, and it's still playing out in how social relationships are happening. And we have to ask others to do the same. And you can come into your school and say, why did you not tell people in your classroom that George Washington owned slaves? You can do it that way. Or you can assume that your teacher is actually an ally. He, she, they may well be. And say, hey, can we talk more about that unit? There are ways of engaging people that actually bring them in. And again, if you're breaking silence, then the teacher can say, you know what, I really wanted to do that, and I got pushback from the principal or whatever. So there's a way of inviting conversation instead of just wagging fingers. All right. Organized and active. This is not going to work if we just write things down and stay in our heads and pray about it. We need one another more than ever. And we really need to work with organizations that are led by communities of color whenever possible. They are on the ground working and have a lot of knowledge and experience. And we can participate in helpful ways, especially with that humble, vulnerable, honest self. And resilient. We have to really learn how to regroup after failures and mistakes. There will be many. We've got to be just gritty and willing to get back up again and take, as Mark said yesterday, one foot again after the other, the switchbacks, for those of you at worship. So now, with all of that, I would like you to take some time to map your own spheres of influence, where you live and work. We can't do everything all at once. So really, just take a minute or two. Did you bring paper? If you didn't, I have some scratch paper and pencils. But I want you to really think about what seems possible for you. Where you work, where you live, who you're having dinner with on a regular basis, or coffee. Where are some places that you feel you could start having some work and conversation? So that's step one. Take 1 minute to just think about that and take some paper if you need it. Here are some pencils. So take a minute and then we'll move on to the next step. Scratch paper is going around. Pencils are going around. Share a pen if you have an extra one, Andy. So just, what we're going to do ultimately is make three columns, so maybe make some space. So your first column are some spheres of influence that you think you might be able to do something with. And leave room for two other columns. Church, housing, family, school, where you work, your social clubs, your sports teams, your people you hang out with for leisure, for sports. Who needs paper, anybody?
Pencils.
Pencils. Where are the pencils? Here they are. How about you up there? Did you all get stuff that you need upstairs? Pencils? Do you need anything?
I'm coming down. Does anybody else want pencils? Okay, I'll get some.
Do you have any tips for introverts?
Yeah. These are not exhaustive, right? I just brainstormed some. You may have well of others. Card club, you know, bridge, golf buddies.
Pencils.
Where are the pencils now?
The pencils are here.
Scratch paper and paint.
Where are you already plugged in and connected? Where do you already have some good relationships? So the next step, after you put on one side your spheres of influence, I want you to list what specific kind of power influence do you have? Are you a supervisor? Are you a teacher? Are you an administrator? Are you a volunteer? Are you a pastor? Are you a deacon? Are you an aunt that everybody listens to, or a grandfather that is revered? Just think about specific kinds of influence and power you have, the capacity you have. Maybe one of your powers is that you make people feel comfortable. Maybe one of your powers is you bring delicious treats and put people at ease. You know, it doesn't have to be just formal leadership. There are all kinds of ways where we have power and influence. And the next thing then is, in each of the spheres, maybe you wrote three spheres, maybe you wrote two, maybe you wrote four, I'd love it if you could try to articulate for yourself a concrete commitment that you could make to do something a little differently. Now that might be hard, and so I'm going to have you speak in small group for a few minutes after you write. But think a little bit about, you know, the next time Uncle Charlie says something about those immigrants, that's one thing, or when my child is ready for school, I think I'm going to research before I decide on schools, you know, those kinds of things. Or, I'm going to work harder to make sure that the next house member from my district is a person of color. I don't know, those are just some ideas, right? So think a little bit about concrete commitments that feel manageable to you. And then we're going to talk and brainstorm, and you can even ask, as was just asked, what do you think it would work for an introvert? I hate bringing uncomfortable things up. And we'll talk more about that too. So commitments. When you're ready, connect with group. I would say groups of four or five max. If it makes sense to talk to people in your own community because you want to work on things together, great. But also make sure to introduce yourselves to other people. It might be helpful to learn from people in other contexts. So if you don't know everyone in your group of four or five, make sure you introduce yourselves. And I'll check in with you, but let's talk. Let's share what you're starting to work on in terms of your spheres of influence, the kind of power influence you might have, and the kind of commitments you're trying to articulate to yourself. Let's share that a bit. I'll check in with you in about 5 minutes and see how you're doing. You could have more time than that. So turn your chairs, make sure you can see people. Introduce yourselves as you need to.
I'm like a
Turkey.
say.
The only one.
Hello, Holdenites. Sorry to interrupt, but you want more time, is that true? You want at least 5 more minutes? Secondly, do you have any questions for me right now, or are you fine? Fine? Okay, 5 more minutes. Enough in and of itself, but it is essential. It's a great thing to do. It's a great beginning place. So it could be raising white kids. It could be, so you want to talk about race. It could be Waking Up White, an amazing memoir about one woman's learning and growth and discovery.
Which one? If you had one to choose.
It depends who you are. If this is all brand new stuff and you've never thought about it at all, Waking Up White, or White Fragility. Why is it so hard for white people to talk about racism? Excellent.
Fragility or what?
White Fragility or Waking Up White. But if you need a shorter read, these are short, accessible chapters. I use this in with my college students. They love it. So you want to talk about race, Ijoma Oluo. If you have children and grandchildren, or you are an educator, or you are just very involved in children's lives in some capacity, raising white kids is outstanding. So it depends who you are and where you're at. If you're a sociologist or you love sociology, Hagerman's book is amazing. So that's one idea. Book group.
Could you give some books as Christmas gifts?
Give some gifts. Yes, Judy.
The thing I want to try to do with my book group is to see if we can do what they did with their churches with my book group. So our congregation has a we read everything kind of book group. What happens if we could get another congregation to say, you know, do you have a book group? How about if we meet together and take terms?
That's great. But two things. One, make sure your congregation, if it's predominantly white, is doing your own work. You may need to read a book together first.
Oh, yeah.
And secondly, understand that coming together with another congregation, if it's predominantly of color, it's a different cost to them to be talking about this issue than to you.
Oh, I'm not suggesting that the books we read would be this issue.
Oh.
Any books, novels.
Yeah.
But that together
we're
sharing.
That kind of share. Yeah, okay, great. So, beyond books, what are we going to do? Come on, people.
I'm going to talk to the relative I don't talk to.
Oh, good luck with that. Google a TED Talk by Rob Willer. It's about having difficult conversations or having hard conversations. How to connect with people across difference so that you connect on values. And even if you disagree on certain things, you can start to hear each other. It might be useful. Rob Willer.
Willer.
W-I-L-L-E-R. It's a TED Talk. Having hard or having difficult conversations, it'll come right up. Okay, so now we might have some conversations. Bringing coffee, making treats are always good for these things. Saying, you know, I really care about you. You've meant a lot to me. But when you said that thing, I need to come back to that. Or this is how it made me feel. You know, those kind of things. Sir, what?
My Lions Club.
What?
My Lions Club. We have about 75 members of my Lions Club.
Oh, yeah.
And we have one member of color.
Uh-huh.
And so my goal is to triple that number by the end of the year.
Yeah, but again, maybe your predominantly white Lions Club needs to do some work before any other...
No, they're very accepting. We just need to invite more people.
Well, yeah, they might be, but if they haven't read any of this stuff, I would invite you all to read some things in your Lions Club first.
Okay.
Promoting affordable housing options in a white community.
Yeah, so who's all involved at all on any local level in any kind of conversation about housing, schools, funding, politics at all? Anybody do that? Can we do that a little bit? What were you going to say, Michael?
Well, as a pastor in my community and as a white person in my community, my voice has some...
Authority.
Yeah.
Yeah, privilege. So, you know, when Mark was in Austin, I started to get a little more connected up with city politics and pay more attention. And I think I have to insert myself more in the local policy.
It matters when people show up in collars at these things.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. How many of us went to a women's march recently, maybe? How many of us have gone to a Black Lives March? Let's do more of that. Let's do more of showing up, not just when it is organized by white women. I could go into more depth, but Jennifer Harvey wrote this really, really outstanding op-ed for on Medium called For White Women Who Need to Learn Calculus While the Building's on Fire. She wrote it during the Blasey Ford hearings, and really, white women, we've too often sided with white privilege. And she really addresses that in an honest, thoughtful way. And she gives you 10 tips how we can do better. I actually don't wear those pink hats. I had two, and now I'm like, you know what? It's not a good hat to wear. And when I go to a climate change march, a Black Lives March, or a march around domestic violence, or sexual harassment and abuse, or around Blasey Ford, or whatever, I make sure that the sign I carry talks about black and brown lives in some way, that they matter. So if you have never been to a protest or a march, they're actually really great. But they're not enough either by themselves. It's great to bring children so they see you witnessing and standing up for things. But only do that if you can also connect it to the local policies, races, elections, debates, city council, aldermanic races, whatever it is. Start local. Local is great. You don't have to start national or state house. You can, but local things really matter. That you can see concrete changes very quickly sometimes. And sometimes a lot of frustration, but then the next election cycle, it changes. Yes, Cindy?
I could talk on and on about Isaiah Minnesota, which is a group that is statewide who has come up with things that jointly we believe in across the state. We influence the state caucus system. We were over 10% of the convention. We were the ones that helped make the decision on who was getting elected. So some of these kinds of things, look in your state, in Washington, there's a wonderful group. Somebody help me. It's
Faith Action Network.
Faith Action Network. Check into what they're doing.
Action Network is great. Also, Sister District, trying to flip states that are flippable and state houses and legislatures.
Yeah.
So not just national houses.
No, this has all been state. And Washington's done an outstanding job. Minnesota's a little bit behind. But look into those kinds of things where you know that there are some people of like mind who are trying to do the same thing.
And if you are an introvert and you don't want to be doing the phone bank, you can lick envelopes and put stamps on things. You can catalog things and do stuff with their Excel spreadsheets. You can print signs and stuff. There's a lot of things that you can do even if you don't want to be picking up the phone and going door to door. Although those are very helpful things to be doing.
What was the sisters?
Sister District.
Where is that?
It's a national grassroots organization. You can connect online with them. Yes, go ahead.
Also, another group is Showing Up for Racial Justice. It's a national
Surge,
group.
S-U-R-J.
S-U-R-J, but you could Google it with your city or the biggest city near you. Like there's a Portland group, and there's this big
one. And that's on the standout, by the way.
It's national. You might have one in your...
Showing Up for Racial Justice. Racial Equity Tools, Crossroads, Anti-Racism, just a few of them. Sister District is not on this handout. If you didn't get this resources page, you should take one. How about if we stop using black in a pejorative way? Or dark? What if we kind of try to make that mental shift?
How do we get all of our pastors to stop wearing white robes?
what if we women, especially, stop saying women anything? Women think, women need. How about if we identify ourselves racially and speak specifically when we mean about specific women? Like the Women's March. You know what? That's always assuming a whole bunch of people who don't necessarily have all the same needs and agendas and thoughts. It's a false uniformity. So what Jen Harvey's saying is that don't reflexively participate in a public action on Facebook called for by white women without checking it out and saying, how is this reading with women of color? Are they on board with this? Or is this another white women's thing? Too often we've wanted to call the shots and we've expected women of color to come along and join our agenda. We have got to shift that. Again, just read this piece and it'll make more sense. She also said read much more media or watch media and read books by feminists of color in particular. And if you don't get it, if a woman of color is saying something that you happen to know on a personal level, don't privately message her and ask her to explain and justify, unless she seems really open to it or whatever. You know, do your own homework. A lot of times we put a lot of pressure on communities of color and for women, other women of color, for white women, other women of color to educate us. And that gets really wearisome and hard. So those are just a few of the things. donate to women of color organizations, help them get elected. Think about where you shop. Think about what businesses you support. Where our dollars go, that really matters a lot. So that's just a little bit from Jennifer Harvey, and I can show you what she looks, here she is. She's ordained in the Baptist, American Baptist Church, and she is a professor at Drake University, and it's an awesome piece. She's all over the speaking circuit right now. She's, yeah, I'm sorry you had to put up with me. I'm second string. No, I'm just kidding. Just being Lutheran. Just being Lutheran. All right, so here are concrete suggestions from Oluo. All right? Vote local. Get in the schools. Bear witness. It's all in the, it's in the off prints, but again, just buy the book so you want to talk about race. It is so darn good. Oh, Benjamin, I talked a little bit about your school.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to say anything about your school, the implicit bias thing?
No.
Okay. So we have about 4 minutes left. And I guess what I would say is most of all, show up. A lot of times people think it's enough to tweet about something. Apparently our president thinks that's enough. I'm sorry, it's Friday. But really showing up with our bodies and our energies and our time. It's not just enough to put a meme on Facebook. You know, it just does not substitute. I mean, sometimes it can help clue in when you're on social networks and you say, hey, everybody, we're meeting at this, or hey, support this or that. It can be helpful communication. But a lot of times people do it as, okay, I've done my social activism today. I said I'm mad about something. That doesn't help so much.
A pastor friend of mine had a cool thing. Every Monday morning, the first thing he does is to, I mean, it's just become part of his Monday habit, is to communicate with legislators or on the governmental level with somebody about one of those issues that's important to him. And he said making it part of his habit, part of his
pattern. Yep, right. That's really well put. And I just want to say, when we start to try to be more present in and with communities of color, when that's new for us, we are going to fumble. It's going to feel awkward. Some of us have never been the only white person in a room in a community of color, and or one of very few. And that's okay. Just remember, part of the process is learning to be more comfortable with being uncomfortable and allowing room for mistakes and gaffes. And if we come it through with authenticity, with critical self-reflection, with the ability to just be a person and humble and say, I got it, or I didn't get it, now I get it, or I'm trying to get it, oftentimes we are received very warmly, especially if we're willing to really lend a hand and dig in and do something useful. Mm-hmm. So if your lives are pretty white, try to find some places where you can be, where you can start to really diversify your time and energy and commitments, and working with people side by side, shoulder to shoulder. So I'm not dying, but it is time for Vegan's last words. And I just want to wish you courage. And remember that hope, I think, is much more a verb than a noun. Mm-hmm. We enact hope. We embody it. And we don't wait for the lightning rod to strike us with hope. The more we try to do things that bring hope, the more it abounds. And it's a long journey. And these years, I tell my students, if you have ever wondered what it was like to live in a critical moment of history, like the Civil War, Revolutionary War, civil rights, look no further. We are living, I believe, one of the most urgent, vital moments in human history.
Amen.
And the story is going to go much further than any of our lives. We're not going to know how the story ends. Not with climate change, not in terms of race relations. So what I try to say is that it's got to be enough that we can say, I was there, and I tried. What I forget too often is what Mark reminded us at worship last night. I'm an ethicist, so I'm constantly thinking about the human moral life. And what I forget, even though I go to church almost every Sunday, is that there is God with us. It's such a foolish thing that God's not just saying, go do it. God is actually here. So I don't do this normally in my classes, but if you are so willing, can we take another minute just to pray together? So you can fold hands, hold hands, have your hands uplifted, however a prayer posture for you. I will start our prayer, but if you feel called to say something silently or aloud, I'll create space for that, and then I'll close it up. Gracious and loving God, who invites us to be both courageous and vulnerable, help us to be better friends and allies to communities of color, to those without the appropriate documentation papers, to those who are too often silenced, ignored, disrespected. Help us learn how to be human and how to be in solidarity, and help us to be trustworthy. Thank you for this time together, for this opportunity to learn with each other. And now please hear our prayers, whether they are spoken aloud or silently in our hearts.
Help us to see your will for us.
God, help us to remember that your measure for our lives is not faith, is not success, but faithfulness. Help us to be faithful.
Gracious God, allow these teachings that we received this week to filter into us, that we bring them with us into our communities, and we allow them to be mixed into who we are every day. Allow us to carry your light of justice into the world.
Help us to get over our stumbles and blunders as we go forth and take risks.
Give us courage to let things get messy.
Remind us not to act out of fear because you do go before us. Help us to walk in your strength and not fear.
We thank you for diversity and keep us grateful always for the differences we see.
God, I trust that you will gather up all these prayers spoken and silently, that you will collect them and take them, that you hear them, and that you will respond. I commend these prayers to you and us to you and to your service. And now, may the God who redeems, strengthens, creates, and cherishes each of us, may the Divine One bless and keep us. May God's face shine upon us and be gracious to us. May God look upon us with favor and give us peace and give us courage. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you so much for your time this morning.